Hi, I'm Kate.
And I'm Lori. We've always thought that the most compelling story strikes the perfect balance between an honest look at the mess of life and the humor that can be found in the mess. To be perfectly honest, we don't really know how to live life without both the humor and the authenticity.
Our podcast might be a little bit of whiplash at times. We can spin from hard and deep to humor and laughing on a dime. The hard will be really hard, and the truths we share are the ugliest of humanity. We don't intend to make it seem like it's all fine or to pretty up the pain, but we also know that the joy we found is all the more profound because of the pain.
So we hope you can stick with us through the ugly, because there will also be joy and hope and humor. Welcome to The Ugly Truth About the Girl Next Door.
Hi, welcome back to our podcast, The Ugly Truth About the Girl Next Door. I'm Kate.
And I'm Lori.
And we're back. And today we have a very, very special guest with us, Lisa Goldblatt Grace, who is the founder and CEO of an organization called My Life, My Choice in Boston, Massachusetts. So Lisa, I'm going to let you introduce yourself, but I have to preface it with saying that this organization was one of our first few contacts in Massachusetts, and we have such high respect for you and for your organization, and we're really excited to talk to you today. So please introduce yourself.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. And as you know, I'm super huge fans. Oh, hey, that's my phone that I left ringing. Please hold. Okay. All right. Now I'm back. Anyway, super huge fans of both of you. And just to correct you, I'm the co-founder and co-executive director. And that feels really important to me, because I've had the privilege of co-founding, co-leading this organization with someone who is a survivor. And that feels really central and important to the work that we do. So we started My Life, My Choice almost 22 years ago, which feels crazy how much time has gone by. And it was in response to the death of a young woman in our community. So Latasha was 17. She was living in a child welfare funded group home. So she wasn't a young person who was like sleeping on a park bench and no adults ever saw her, right? There were adults who were seeing her every day in this program. She had an aunt who loved her very much. She was not completely untethered. But at that time, nobody knew what to look for or what they were seeing. And she was being controlled by an exploiter and exploited commercially sexually exploited. And she was murdered as a result. And at the time of her death was the first time here in Massachusetts that people came together to say, you know, was this an isolated incident or the tip of the iceberg? And we very quickly found out what you already know, which is that is the tip of the iceberg. And we built My Life, My Choice from that time, and started really tiny, and then continued to grow and kept trying to meet the different needs that we learned and that we found in our community. So we really began with a focus on prevention. We have a prevention model that both works with young people at greatest risk of being exploited, but also the kind of systems of care around them, particularly the congregate care programs, where we can kind of wrap around them a really intentional model of prevention. And we train folks on using our curriculum and using this model all over the country. And we're excited that it has an evidence base based on a 3-year National Institute of Justice study of that work. Part of what we do is training. We do that locally and nationally for service providers and law enforcement, and create trainings that help folks do their job better when they meet a young person, to know how to identify a young person who's being exploited and know what to do. So not kind of generalized awareness trainings, but really skill-based trainings. And we do those based on what the field needs, and we continue to evolve. We're super excited. We're launching this spring a 10-session clinical course specifically for therapists, because we kept hearing from young people that the therapists they were meeting like didn't get it. And people who become therapists want to heal, they want to help. And so they were hungry for information on what are the best practices there. And so with the help of some incredible folks from around the country, and then our amazing staff, as well as young people who we've served, we've created this 10-session course, and we're super excited about launching that. Part of what we do is policy and advocacy work. And so trying to ensure that the kind of legislation that's out there and the policies that are created are ones that push forward this movement and we're kind of on the right side of history with that. And then lastly, and kind of central, though, I'm saying it last, but it's central to everything we do, are our direct services, where we serve young people in Massachusetts, about 220 that we served last year in Eastern Mass, for folks who are aware of the geography. And we serve young people from under the age of 18. They get referred to us, but we'll serve them as long as they want support, which feels really important to us. So we, once a young person is a member of My Life, My Choice, they're part of us. And so we'll support them as long as they want that support, which is often well into their 20s. And the way we support centers around our survivor mentoring program, where each young person is paired with someone who has this lived expertise, this lived experience, for one-on-one relationship as long as that young person wants it. And then we wrap around any other service that they need. So intensive case management if needed. We do provide clinical services in-house. We do workforce development. We do a lot of leadership work, and we try to really create a sense of belonging and connection for the young people we serve, that really centers around love and them feeling really seen and cared for. And that also was evaluated in our National Institute of Justice study, or the one done on our program and found to have an evidence base. So we are excited to continue to grow and change as we have been, staying true to our core of being survivor-led, and ensuring that that's the most important voice in the room in our program development and in all the work we do with young people. And the other piece that feels really important to who we are and what we do is keeping up the sense of outrage that this is allowed to happen, and trying to be as loud as possible.
There's actually so many things that I feel the need to comment on. One, the fact that so I remember when we came to your fundraiser, it was the first time we were really meeting you guys, really interacting with My Life, My Choice at all. In June, we attended your fundraiser, and the thing that struck us both was that idea of coming around survivors with love, right? And how, I don't know, that hasn't been our experience. People don't really seem to understand that.
Relationship matters.
Relationship really matters. Yeah. And it was like, we know that, but it was really new for us to hear an organization talk about that on such a public, I mean, literally, I think it was Audrey who was talking about how she just loves the women that she works with, the people that she works with. She loves the survivors. And we both literally were like crying, like, in, you know, at this fundraiser, because it was so,
we've gotten so much pushback about the nature of our relationship and the fact that I have shown Kate this connection and love, and there's this relationship between us that I think we are acknowledging is really central to survivorship and healing and thriving. And yet those of us in these kind of roles are sort of expected to keep a certain amount of professional emotional distance, which just doesn't work.
Because that's how we're trained. Right. And there's a difference between having good boundaries, right? And showing real love. And why would we think every single child I've ever met, every young person, every adult needs love to flourish and to thrive? Why would we think that that could be absent in these relationships? And we work really hard to make sure that's organic and real. So it's not like you walk in and we say, welcome to My Life, My Choice. We love you. That would be creepy. And they would be like, we don't, you know, you don't
You're
know me. But as we get to know young people, that part feels really important, to reflect back to them what we see and what we admire and what we care about. Because for many of the young people we serve, that's been absent in their life, or it's been conditional in their life. And so we want them to be able to build relationships for themselves in the future that are built on real, authentic love. Part of what we need to do is demonstrate it, again, with good boundaries, but but it's got to be real, because young people can spot not real from a mile away.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We were just so struck by that. And I think it's part of the reason that we, like I said, highly, highly respect you guys and the work that you guys are doing, and the model that you follow, the inclusivity of just all of the things. We have such respect for you guys. So that is where My Life, My Choice started. But what about you, Lisa? Where did your career start?
So let me just comment on that, because part of what we are
we talk about is we want to bring more people on the journey with us than are currently on the journey, right? That idea that there are people out there who are perhaps have capacity and some amount of desire to be doing something meaningful, but yet they're either afraid to try or they're not prepared to be uncomfortable or whatever. And so we really want to help people kind of have a sense of like, okay, you didn't just hatch one day. Like how did you become the person who, when Latasha died, you stepped into this space?
And because what we continuously say is survivor led absolutely all the way. Like I'm a survivor, obviously. And so that's absolutely, that voice needs to be there, but survivors don't really have a choice, right? I mean, they could choose not to lead. They could choose not to step into that space, but they're facing this every day, all day, whether they want to or not. But then there's people like you and like Lori, who you could have said, no, you could have said, this isn't for me. This is too hard. Right. And you didn't. And so it takes those people too, together. Actually, I'm so glad you corrected me. I'm having it be co-founded and co-led because it takes both. It really does. And so that's why we're encouraging more people who, even if it doesn't directly affect you, get involved, right? Do the hard thing.
Yep.
So, why did you say yes?
Okay. Well, I'll start before that, if that's useful, a little bit. You know, I've always worked with really marginalized teenagers. I just really like teenagers, and I like the honesty and the anger and all the things that's where, you know, I just have always loved it. But there's like a couple places in my career prior to starting My Life, My Choice that were really salient and substantive for me. That I just lift up, and then you could always cut them if they're not useful. One was that after I graduated in college, I was a VISTA volunteer, which now would be called AmeriCorps, and I was placed in the Navajo Nation working in the school system there. And when you think of culturally responsive and culturally respectful, whatever is the opposite of that was what it was like being placed there at that time. And I learned a tremendous amount. And one of the most important things I learned is about kind of owning the color of my skin and owning my life experience as different from someone, but like owning kind of everyone who had come before me and done harm. And I feel like that piece of what can be placed together to become allyship is something that I really learned that year, because I really didn't go in knowing any of that. And then fast forward some years, and I was brought in to create and develop and run a diversion program for young people who'd been convicted of offenses, and as a kind of last option before they would be sentenced. And, you know, I created this model, and I was working with this partner to do so. And then it became so clear really quickly that I wasn't the most credible messenger, right? As someone who hadn't had the same experiences as the young people I was serving. And that I could say as much as I wanted that there was another option, another path, but I couldn't embody it. And so I worked with my co-person, and we advocated for more funding and kind of shifted things around and hired a young man who had just come out of incarceration and a young woman, and not just, but had been out for a bit and had really strong, robust lives. And they became the center of that program. And then what I found is if the credible messenger is front and center, if the person that can really inspire real hope is front and center, then my role as an ally becomes so clear. I can set up the circumstances for that to work, and I can be, there's all these other things I could bring to the program, and I brought them, but only once that bridge had been built by someone who got it at a level I didn't. And that really stuck with me and stayed with me until, you know, coming into My Life, My Choice. And another, just I'll offer one more lesson, is after that I ran, I'm 105 years old, as you can tell by the number. Parts of the story, but I ran a shelter for teen moms, and I loved that. And I was a lesson there was the way we pathologize, the way people naturally react to challenging circumstances. I don't know if that makes sense, but I saw in the years I was running that shelter before I had a baby, I watched and was part of, frankly, the way we would say, like, oh, we're, you know, I have so many concerns about this mom, she's not bathing her baby, or like whatever the thing was. And then I had a baby. I realized they're really, really hard and they're really like slippery when wet, and like I couldn't possibly bathe them, and came back to that job saying, oh, right, like people's natural, like there's a natural reaction to challenging circumstances, and it's real and it's valid, and we've got to be so careful about pathologizing it. Anyway, those are some like key learnings for me. And it was after that experience, and I was working on a bunch of different projects when Latasha died, and I was actually hired along with a survivor who's no longer doing the work, but who thankfully introduced me to Audrey, who then quickly stepped in, and we did all the work together. She and I were kind of paired on a 3-week consulting contract to try and figure out what a response model could look like. And at that time, I felt like I knew a lot about really marginalized kids and what they needed. And I'm telling you, I knew nothing about this, absolutely nothing. And she knew everything about this because she had lived it and she was doing street outreach at the time. And so we spent 3 weeks basically locked in a room together. I just listened, and she brought different people to come to me to kind of tell me their stories and share what they were experiencing. And I spent time trying to look at what could we learn from other public health models or other things that are happening. And I talked to our 4 mothers in the field. There was only a few at that time. And by the end of 3 weeks, we felt like not only did we have an idea of what should happen, but we felt like we were the people to do it. And so we did. And you asked like kind of why it felt like, I mean, there's a few things I felt at that time and continue to feel, but it's like, it just felt like, right. I felt like there was this piece of this that I could do. I knew the pieces that I couldn't. I knew how important it was to center the lives of people who'd been there, but I thought there was this other piece that I could do. And it just felt like what I was supposed to be doing next. And then it was really, this is going to sound really messed up, but like, it was just really fun and rewarding. And when I say fun, that's not the right word, because it was painful to know that this was happening, but I was encountering like extraordinary resilience all the time, and strength and incredible humor and just powerful young people and powerful adults. And, you know, we always say that when we're hiring people to work at My Life, My Choice, we say like martyrs need not apply, you know, like and I think that's really important for anybody who wants to work in this field and in this movement. Like if you're doing it just because it feels like this needs to happen. And that's a piece of it. I mean, that level of outrage that I felt that this was happening and that I had missed it and others were missing it all the time. I mean, that's there, but it has to make you feel every day like this is the piece of the pie that I'm supposed to be involved in. And if it's not, there's so many other pieces of the pie. The pie is so big, the pie of things that need to be corrected and improved and worked on, and on our whole planet, you know, is huge. But so it needs to feed your spirit in a way that you just feel like, yep, this is what I'm supposed to be doing.
I think the word you were trying to find was maybe energizing, for one thing.
Yeah, that's better than fun.
Yeah, but I understand what you're saying. Like,
I also think though that like when you said humor, I feel like that's part of what makes it like feel transparent. Not feel transparent, it is transparent, but is that like ability to just, you have to laugh or you're gonna just cry all the time.
Yeah.
You know, and so it is like, I don't know, I have fun doing our training.
Yeah.
Sometimes depends on the training, I guess. But
right. And there's all pieces of it doesn't mean that there aren't days that I've gotten in my car and cried the whole way home, and for sure. And that's part of it too. But yeah, I mean, I think all of us who are invested in, you know, for the risk of sounding like I'm in a pageant, but like make the world a better place, right? You have to just figure out what's your piece of the pie. What's the piece that you feel like you can do? And that is good for you. And that feels really important.
Have you been in a pageant, Lisa?
I have not, but thank you so much for asking.
You're welcome. I wanted to be clear.
My time may be yet to come.
So yeah, I mean, you have so much
for the 105-year-olds. Right.
Maybe at 110.
Yeah. Yes, at 110 will be my pageant work.
My pageant work. Oh my gosh. No,
I just think that idea that we think that avoiding things that are hard is actually the best way to live a life. And it actually makes for a very shallow, flat, in some cases, colorless life. And doing hard things you can manage the proportion of that, hard things is actually enlivening and encouraging. And honestly, I say regularly to people, like, honestly, a lot of times I'd rather spend time with the people I meet in my office than the people I meet on the street. Cause at least the people I meet here are actively pursuing something, something of meaning, something of purpose, something of growth. And that's a whole, honestly, I'd rather spend my time with people like that. So,
yeah, no. And I think, to piggyback on that, I think that when, people will say, like, right, how can you do this work? It's so sad. And it doesn't feel that way, but it also, when you feel like you're having a meaningful part of something, then it just feels okay. Like, I'm not doing enough around climate change, and that stuff keeps me up at night, because like, I'm recycling and that's it, right? Like, that's not enough. So it's the things where like, I'm not having any impact that feel the most overwhelming. But when you feel like, not I can do it all, or I'm even gonna end something or be the end all on something, but then you can feel like you can just like kind of keep going. It feels much better than the stuff you're not doing.
I think that what you just referenced is important for people to notice, right? So you're talking about climate change and the fact that you are aware of it. And that is part of what makes the difference in people who get on the train to make a positive ripple and people who don't is, can you really look away and numb yourself to, are you willing to, are you trying to just avoid facing what's in front of you? Or are you someone who, I can't not see it. I see it. And now I'm either going to just be sad about it, or I'm going to do something about it.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean doing everything. Right. Not everybody's going to start a nonprofit. Not everybody's going to run My Life, My Choice, right? But just like, you're not going to necessarily change climate change.
Right.
Not with just my recycling.
I'm not clear on that,
but I trust that somebody else will, because somebody else, that's what gets them up in the morning.
But it doesn't
to do it, right? Like,
ignore it, that you're like, it's not happening, because I can't do it, it's not happening. You know what I mean? So if you don't have to be able to change the whole of it, or be the whole of it in order to do something.
Find your place. Yeah.
I constantly reference we talk about this all the time, that just do something, right? It doesn't even have to be with us or with you or whoever, just do something, because you can't be listening to this podcast and then pretend you didn't hear it. So do something.
Right.
And then I usually reference Daniel Tiger. Do you know Daniel Tiger? Daniel Tiger is an offshoot of Mr. Rogers. And there's
That I got you there.
Yeah.
You
know Daniel Tiger?
Daniel Tiger, puppet? Right.
Oh, of course.
There's a remake of some of it.
It's a cartoon. Yeah. And there's a whole song, like, everyone can do something.
I love it.
She won't sing it for me, though. I don't know why.
Just sing it. Go she Google it.
Maybe you could end this time. Yeah, no, I think that's so true, is that once you know, you don't ever get to not know again. And that's so true about the commercial sex industry and trafficking, and the fact that there's so many ways that people can make an impact without starting an organization, right? It's how we raise our kids. It's how we, all those pieces.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I'm thinking about my adult children, and I wonder, you can pass on commenting on this, but I have both... had to apologize to my adult children. I put that in air quotes because I'm not really sorry.
Sorry, not sorry.
It's a sorry, not sorry thing, because all three of my adult children are present human beings in this world and are living lives in which they cannot and do not turn away from whatever is in front of them. And it can be a difficult road, right? In many ways, being blissfully ignorant is easier. It's not more vibrant. It's not a more enriched life, but it certainly is easier.
Yep. Yeah.
Like, that's the hope, right? Is that we're gonna inspire more and more people to get on the train, because it is a much more vibrant, rich life than if you're just neutral.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I feel the same way about my adult kids. And it's, it is a funny, when my daughter went, was in ninth grade and went to the high school, there was a Students Against Human Trafficking club, right? That she joined and wound up getting very involved with. But, and they did really neat stuff. But she tells the story of like the first day of that club meeting, and who, you know, the older students talking about like, this is what it is and this is what's happening, and people being like, oh my God, I had no idea. And her being like, really? This isn't what your family talks about, like, it's over dinner? Like, this is not what you talk about all the time. Like, how is that possible? And my poor boys, I mean, that, you know, when you think about what can you do, you can talk to your sons about that it's never okay to buy or commodify a human being. And, you know, any long car ride, my poor boys would just be like, oh my God, how are we talking about pornography again? How is this possible? You know? But it's like, oh, we're all looking straight ahead. This is a perfect time to just talk about the impact of, you know, the porn industry or trafficking or, you know, right? But we all can do that. Nobody, and in fact, nobody gets to not do that. And as far as my judgmental self.
No, 1,000% agreed. And that's, the whole point of trying to make is in your circle of influence, one of your circles of influence is your children. My son, my oldest is in sixth grade. First week of sixth grade, he walked
first week of middle school.
Yeah, walks up to his health teacher.
Oh God!
Says, "Will we be covering child sexual abuse in this class?"
Oh my God, I love him.
I've never been more proud and horrified in my life, because I'm like, I'm not like, oh baby, like okay, you know, but also like, yeah, that's my son.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Here's the one of the horrifying parts.
Yeah.
That teacher did not follow up with him. No guidance counselor, nobody followed back with him to say, hey buddy, like,
can
we talk about why you asked that question? For you. Like how, what do you need?
Wow.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Major disappointment there, but more power to my, to our kids who are saying yes to that, whether they want to or not.
Well, and I feel like anybody who listens to your podcast, which is amazing, like as you know, there's a lot of podcasts out there. They could be listening to Celebrity Memoir Book Club, which is like really fun, but like a totally different thing, right? Like, and they're choosing to spend the limited time that we all have in hearing not just your story, but like the story and development of all the work that you guys have done and all you're thinking about. And so that means that they're taking a step, and that's huge, right?
Yeah.
It's really huge.
Okay, so on that note, in your 20 years of My Life, My Choice, is that where we're at?
Almost 22.
Oh my goodness. How have you guys seen, you know, the commercial sex industry and what CSEC looks like? How have you seen that change? And how have you guys adapted as it has changed?
Yeah. So I'll start by talking about the hard stuff and then a little bit of what feels hopeful. When we started this work, the kids were quite literally on the street, right? They were on the streets of Boston and other cities in Massachusetts, pretty exclusively. And, you know, that's horrendous. And the upside of that is they were seen, right? People knew that this was happening because they would see them, the young people and the adults. It's not really particularly helpful to, we focus on young people, but our real mission is that this doesn't happen to anybody, because our young people become the adults, right? It's all the same person. But anyway, so it was much more something that was visible. And as you know, over the last 22 years, most of the selling has happened now online, and kids report to us being in hotels and motels and apartments in the cities and in the suburbs and more rural areas. And so they're really not seen. I mean, the only person people seeing them are, you know, the exploiter that maybe put them there and the stream of men who come through, maybe housekeeping, and we're working on that. And so that change to it being something that you don't see is made it that much more insidious. it's allowed exploiters to groom that many more young people at the same time, right? They used to have to work one young person at a time and hang out in areas they thought they would reach kids or just marginalized people. And now you can do that much more effectively and efficiently online through social media. I remember being in a training and someone saying, like, we just need to teach our kids never to go meet someone that they've only met online. And somebody else was like, that's the entire way that I date. And everybody else was like, yeah. You know, like, it's an outdated idea to think that our kids aren't going to build relationships online and then move them to being in person, right? So that change with the internet has, just made that all of that much harder. On the upside is when we first started doing trainings in 2002, and they were 3-hour trainings because that was the maximum of what we knew. We are presenting to you everything we know. Here it is. And now, you know, obviously we train for days at a time, but, we'd spend the majority of a training just trying to convince the people in the training that, that this wasn't delinquency, that it was victimization, that it wasn't promiscuity, that it was victimization, that young people in these situations were worthy of their like attention and caring. And we don't have to do that in quite the same way anymore. No one walks in making jokes about it. Nobody, there's a level of understanding of this as victimization, and anybody who doesn't really buy it knows enough not to say it out loud, right? Like, there has been that shift. I feel like the next step of that is, you know, we really operate on the principle that there's no such thing as other people's children, right? And that we all have responsibility for all kids, whether they look like you or they don't, whether they come from your neighborhood or they don't, whether you can imagine it happening to your child or not, it really doesn't matter. And that's been a harder, longer sell. Like, I feel like we're still working on that one, shifting that norm.
In the trainings that we are starting to do, we spend a great deal of time trying to just show people that this happens in this way, right? Yeah. That we go through this, like, level one understanding of it's happening in Cambodia. Like, we have celebrities.
Yeah.
You know, everybody knows, like, Sound of Freedom, blah, right? All the things. Yeah. And then level two, it's happening in the US, but it's only happening to this subset of, you know, marginalized people and et cetera, et cetera. But then it's level three, like, are you understanding that it can actually happen to literally anyone? And there's so many different ways in which it can happen and which ways that people can have access to children, or to people, like you said, adults as well. But we spend a great deal of time feeding those statistics and feeding that information. So that's not just like, yeah, my story is a one-off horrifying, you know, it's like, no, it's actually pretty common, unfortunately. And so, yeah, that makes sense to me that it's like, we are constantly having to be like, open your eyes, just stretch a little further. Like, you know what happens. Can you see that it happens like this?
So I feel like what we're saying is, like, step one is, okay, can we get our head and our heart around the fact that it happens, and it happens right in your backyard in spite of what you think?
Right.
Then can we also help you realize why you should care, mm-hmm. right? Just because you're a human being and a member of society, you should care. And on top of that, by the way, there's a huge price that our society, our cultures are paying because of the woundedness that is around us.
Yeah, that's right.
We should care. You should just care.
I agree with all.
Yeah.
Don't
be an asshole.
That's pretty basic.
Right. That being,
you might want to cut.
That being the bumper sticker.
Yeah. Just don't do it.
So I very anecdotally have said my basic sense of it is, like, about 20% of the population is actively doing good.
Yeah.
About 20% mm-hmm. is actively doing evil, pursuing evil. And there's 60% mm-hmm. of people in the middle that are sort of floaters, right? We need some of that 60%. Hop on the train. It's great over here. There's our purpose.
Right. Water's warm.
Come on over.
Yeah.
It is the crazy train. No, it's not bad.
Right. No, absolutely. Absolutely agree. We had the experience once of, you know, we had gotten, this was years ago, years and years, maybe like 8 to 9, where we had gotten a series of no's from a number of like law firms and companies to sponsor and to support our work. And so one of our board members, who's amazing, brought together the leaders of these companies, or the people who said no, to try and help figure out why. Mm-hmm. And I was allowed to come, but I wasn't allowed to speak. So I was like in the corner doing like yoga breaths, like, you know,
woo.
And it was super telling and super helpful. I mean, people said really directly, either like, when you talk to me about kids with cancer, I imagine that could happen to my child. But if you tell me about this, this is never going to happen to my child. So I can't, you know, it doesn't move me. So that was one, right? And that's disturbing on two fronts, right? It's disturbing to believe it could never happen to your child. And it's disturbing that you feel like if it doesn't happen to my child, it's not painful. And I don't know how you can move in the world not feeling the pain of, you know, everyone's kids. And then the other was a very direct ask that we only told the stories of white girls from the suburbs, from healthier families who had this happen to them. Again, with this idea that then I could imagine it happening to my perfect family. And, you know, we did some soul searching with that because I could tell you some of those stories, right? Like, we know those kids. And we weren't willing to only tell that story in order to raise money. Like, we were just not willing to do it. And so that we needed to be true to all the levels of marginalization and isolation that renders this to happen. And, you know, I feel like when I used to think, didn't last long, but my initial thought, and I think it's still really pervasive, is this idea that trafficking is like one bad thing in an otherwise perfect life for young people. And that happens, but like almost never, right? It's so frequently in the context of other really painful things, and it's just part of it. I don't know. And that feels like an important piece for people to hold on to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I think what we found with the podcast was what we've said a lot of the time with Mezzo is that if someone like me can't get help, who can, right? That is why it's like, okay, we have to do something. Because I mean, I have a degree, I'm educated, I did, you know, have all the right, I'm putting that in quotes, nobody can ever see me. And I'm always using hand motions, but the right things, right? And I still couldn't find help, and I still couldn't get free. And so if I can't, who the fuck can? Right.
Add in all the, I forgot we can swear on this.
Yeah.
If you notice. So I will amend that before the end. Right. Like, if you add on additional layers of marginalization, that's why it's so powerful, Kate, like your willingness to share about this. And it's not your responsibility, and you don't have to. And I'm sure you've been told that 1,000 million times. But the fact that you have chosen to, it builds a bridge to help people like understand.
Right. What we found is that the surge of support came when it was a feeding of the beast, right? My gosh, this happened in my neighborhood. Right. This happened on Grand Island.
Right.
What do I need to know for my children because I attend that church or I attended that church, right? And now when we're on kind of the downhill of this and going, okay, but this is a thing that happens. Okay, yes, it happened to me. Yes, I am every day still safety planning and every day living in this whirlwind that I'm living in. But also, so are 41% of, right? So, and yet it's like, oh yeah, but that doesn't affect me. And so what affected me was that it happened on Grand Island and I attended that church, and what do I need to know to keep my kids safe?
Yes.
But now I'm less than willing, and not everybody there, we still have so many people that are supportive and that are like, okay, yeah, tag me in, right? How do I help? What do I do? And we're so grateful for that. But we've noticed this sort of downtick in when we start to talk about it in the context of
the broader
concern, the greater good, right? And that is upsetting to us. Like, it's like, oh, okay.
It's harsh when you see it. And it's so powerful that you're not willing. You could have been like, oh, look at the support that I'm getting. I'm going to leave it there. But you didn't. And you're like, nope, the tent is much bigger than me and my experience. And I think what you say about, right, if you were unable to get the help that you needed, like, how are we expecting kids with so many more layers of marginalization, you know, in our communities? And, you know,
we're all acknowledging it's
really powerful
that way.
It shouldn't be that way. It absolutely shouldn't be that way.
But it unfortunately is.
But it is that way. And that's unsettling. It's very, and how are kids supposed to, right? We talk about this a lot in our training too. Like, I'm an adult. I'm an educated adult with a husband and a family and a house. And I was still being stalked and assaulted and not okay at all, and could not get someone to listen and help until we took matters into our own hands and started a podcast out of desperation. It should never have taken that. And if I cannot get the help that I needed from the places that should have helped, how do we expect a child who is stuck in this situation to now use their voice, use their power, right? Like, when they've been programmed.
Right.
What are all the things that go into that? How are do that if I could?
And when they do and they're not believed, which I know you have the experience too, right? Like that, how extraordinarily damaging that is for anybody to not be believed and to have the systems of care that are supposed to be put in place to care and in fact instead to blame.
So my oldest son is home visiting right now from Michigan, and he is a physical therapist who works primarily in pain science. And so we've been having all of these conversations about what are the pieces that make the difference between someone who now figures out how to kind of build a life and to cobble together pieces of things to be able to launch into something different for their life than the trauma that they kind of started in. What are the factors? And I think sometimes people choose to turn away from the ugliness and the wounding that is in front of them because they feel so overwhelmed. Like you feel about climate change. Like, I don't even know where to begin. Where do I begin? So sometimes we're inclined to be like, I got nothing. Right. Yeah. But everybody can do something, right?
Yeah.
There are so
Daniel
many
ways. Tiger.
Right. We have talked about this on the podcast.
Come back to Daniel Tiger.
I'm going to make you sing it sometime.
No, I'm not going to do it. It's not happening.
It could be today. I would love to.
We'll applaud.
It's okay. We'll tag it. It's in the show notes.
All right. It's in the show notes. There you go. Okay. But that idea that we can all think about that there have been people who they may not realize the enormous impact that they had on our trajectory of our life, but we know, right?
Yeah.
They may have shown up for a window of time in what they considered a small way, but it matters. And so why can't we be that for somebody else, right? So maybe you're not prepared to start a nonprofit or like volunteer your time in an intense kind of way, but there's always something that you can do in your circle of influence to make a difference that maybe is going to move the needle for the kid in front of you, for the person in front of you.
It's the pickle jar analogy.
Do you know, I don't know
the
that
pickle
one.
Jar analogy? No. Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. I live by this. Okay. So let's say I take a new jar of pickles off the shelf. And I go to try and open it and I can't. So I hand it to you, Lori, and you go to try and open it and you can't. And you hand it to Kate and you try to open it. And so it goes down, and maybe the eighth person, they open it and they think they're a freaking hero, right? Because they're like, I'm the strongest person here and I open it. Well, no, the reason they were able to open it and have that good outcome was like all the things that happened along the way. And so like, I very much try to live my life as with that acknowledgement that I'm just somewhere along the way in the pickle jar. And maybe once in a blue moon, you get to be the one that opens the jar. You get to have some moment that feels like incredibly amazing for you and for the person in front of you or the issue you're trying to impact. But most of the time it doesn't feel that way. And you just have to have that faith that you're part of the pickle jar
I love that.
It fell a little flat there at the end, but you get what I'm going with.
Yes. Absolutely. That's fantastic. Yes. I love that.
I'm literally writing that down so it can be part of my.
Yeah, because it's a combination of like, don't put so much on your own shoulders that right. you have to be the end all and be all.
Right.
And by the way, don't like carry that like the crown on your head, like, oh,
thank
boy,
you.
Look what I've done.
The saviorism is not so helpful, not useful at all. No.
And it,
I mean, I guess there'd be a better analogy where the pickle jar was helping to open you as well. But it doesn't really work.
It doesn't work.
But that is how it works in real life, right? Like it's a mutual process that when you engage, you get something too. That's how it works.
Absolutely. I know. So back to the 60%. Some of you out there listening to us who are in the 60% who are floating, hop on over to the 20% that are actively doing good. It's fulfilling out here.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And there's so many, you know, go to your website, go to our website, like you'll get ideas. You'll be given options of things you can do.
Yeah. And we've said that before. It doesn't have to be us. It doesn't have to be you. Just do something, right? Yes. You can't unknow this truth. And so lean into it, lean into the knowing.
Yeah. I love that. It's a great message.
Do you have anything else that you'd like for our,
check your notes.
Listeners, I always feel like I don't even know. I have so much imposter syndrome all the time when we podcast that I'm like, ugh.
Oh gosh, I swim in my imposter syndrome all the time. So I'm right with you. What else do I want people to know? Just like how grateful I am for the work that you guys are doing and how there was this Lori and Kate shaped hole in the movement that you guys have stepped into. And it's really great. That if people do want to learn more about the work that we're doing, go to mylifemychoice.org or follow us on social media. And that's such an easy thing to do. Reshare a post, reshare an article, weigh in on something. It's, you know, keep educating yourself. And I think that's about it. I'm really grateful to have had the chance to talk to you guys. It was really fun. Yeah. I think as an outro, isn't that what they call the thing at the end?
Yeah.
I think it really should be the song. I'm going to turn it over to Kate.
I wish there was a pickle jar song, to be honest with you. That would be better. If there was a Daniel Tiger pickle jar song, I would do that.
We're going to have to find a picture of Daniel Tiger with a pickle jar.
Yeah,
pickle jar.
That's what I can do. Yeah, you probably can help us with that.
Yes. Oh my God. We could do that in a minute.
Let's not go down that road.
That's a different podcast.
But yeah.
Yes.
Thank you guys so much for the time.
So
it was really fun.
Yeah. We're so grateful for you.
Be well.
Yes.
Bye.
I don't know how to stop recording this.
Do I?
Just hang on.
I don't know. Do I? Everyone is big enough to do something. If you or someone you know is stuck in a trafficking situation and needs help, please reach out to the National Human Trafficking Hotline by calling 1-888-373-7888 or text HELP, HELP, to 233-733.